Hello, 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 and welcome back to this week's episode of the Mike the Gardener Gardening Podcast, sponsored by those lovely people at Natural Grower, who supply plant-based products for both organic and chemical-free gardening and your houseplants. So, how are you all? How are you coping with the hot weather? In the UK, and I know in Europe, temperatures have soared in recent weeks, and at the time of recording this episode, we have just recorded the hottest day in the UK ever, with 40.2 degrees at London's Heathrow Airport. Phew, what a scorcher, I think we're legally obliged to say. It really is a sign of global warming and ever-changing weather patterns around the world, and as gardeners, we'll need to see how we adapt to our gardens, how we plant, and some of our practices to ensure our gardens, and indeed us, can cope with the hot, dry, prolonged weather. Anyway, I'll step down from my soapbox for the time being. I'll probably get back up though soon though. Anyway, I'm going to introduce you to this week's wonderful guest. Now, I'm delighted to be joined this week by Val Bourne. Val is a lifelong hands-on organic gardener with a passion for plants. She writes for many publications, including the Daily Telegraph, judges RHS Floral and Dahlia Trials, lectures widely, produces books with an organic theme, and always everything enthusiastically. And most of all, Val gardens at Spring Cottage in the stunning Cotswolds, which is exactly where I joined her to record this podcast. And, despite the soaring temperatures in the days ahead of my visit, Val's garden looked exquisite. Just so many plants and a stunning grow-your-own area to one side of the garden. I asked Val how long she and her best beloved had been at the garden and what it looked like when they arrived.
Well, I came here, I hope I've got the right year, I'm not good with numbers, November 2004. And the only thing in this garden at the time were six line posts, a cottage garden peony, which I managed to kill.
How did you do that?
I don't know. I dug it up and moved it and I never saw it again. I think it was shock. And some alchemilla and lots of weeds. But when spring came, actually, there were a lot of very old daffodils that had been in the garden for years and years, and they're quite simple shapes. So it wasn't completely devoid of plants, but it wasn't an ornamental garden. It had been run as a sort of veg plot.
So what was it that sold the cottage to you? Was it the garden or the cottage itself or a combination of both?
I wouldn't say this cottage was sold to me. I was presented with a fait accompli when my partner at the time, who I call the best beloved, had seen the cottage and we'd visited it together a few months earlier when it was for sale and it got withdrawn. And he loved it. Mm. And he went off and bought it at auction without telling me.
Oh dear.
He phoned my daughter and said, I'm going to make a grand romantic gesture. And she phoned me and said, it'll be a bunch of flowers from Tesco. But I thought perhaps after knowing someone for about 8 or 9 years, perhaps there might be a proposal coming, but there wasn't. It was this cottage.
Well, that, as far as grand romantic gestures go, that's a big gesture, isn't it?
Well, it was, except that it was a very basic cottage. It was very uncomfortable living here for the 4 years that before we started the renovation. But I think we had a few false starts because we wanted a greenhouse because we're both green people. Mm. And we had an architect design like a great big greenhouse front on the front. And I'm so grateful that we never went with it because I think we might have died after the heat that we've just endured. So we were quite slow and methodical, and Joe particularly was slow and methodical, which is his style.
So you say you're both green. So in terms of the design, the layout, the planting of the garden, who's chief in charge? Is it you or the best beloved?
Oh, That's such a difficult question.
And tell me, who's in charge? Go on.
I think you get different answers from both of us because I don't know. I think I'm more in charge with the planting, with the ornamental planting, definitely.
Okay, so in terms of the... Because there was nothing here apart from the bits and pieces you mentioned. So how did you... Did you have a plan in mind? Did you actually sit down around a table and design it?
No, I'm not a garden designer. And we had quite a lot of lively discussions, shall I say. And one of the things Joe wanted to do was he wanted to rotivate areas of the garden. And I was really against this because we can't use toxins to get rid of weeds because we're both green. Mm. But actually it was a really good system, I have to say, because it split up things like the bindweed and the switch and things into sections. And we will always have a weed problem in this garden because we've got very old stone walls around the edge and we get ground elder and bindweed in the garden. And I think we just made four flower beds, experimental flower beds, sort of up there a bit because it's a sloping garden and it was in one of the warmer, more exposed parts of the garden. And we tried things. And I'd had a very dry garden 19 miles further east. And I put things in that I'd grown before, like Nepeta Six Hills Giant. And I quickly realised that they were never going to do here because, A, we're cold. We get quite a lot of rain dumped on us, although we're getting less and less over the years. Mm. And we've got spring water that comes out on the other side of the wall. So... there are lots of things that I grew at Hook Norton that I couldn't grow in those beds.
So you've a passion for plants. When did that passion start? What started you? Am I right in saying your grandmother as a young child inspired you and you gardened with her?
She definitely did because I'm a very active person. I woke up at 5 o'clock this morning. Really popular with the best beloved.
Best beloved's a little bit later than 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, yes. But I wake up early and I'm one of those people, I don't wake up and doze for half an hour and think about getting up. I'm one of those people, I'm fast asleep, I sleep really well and then I'm awake and I'm you know, mouth engaged, very, very active. And I was a twin. And in those days, twins always shared cots, bedrooms, prams. And he was a much sleepier child, so I got lifted out and she took me in the garden. And she was a really interesting person because she would tell me stories about plants. Like she explained that alchemilla was to do with alchemists and that was turning base metals into gold. She extended plants for me into tales, really, because she was born in 1881. She was like Queenie in Lark Rise to Candleford. If you had a toothache, you got a clove. If you had a tummy ache, you had a mint tea. You know, she was very much of that era. But she was she'd had a big garden. She had a load of catalogues in the bottom of the wardrobe. And I remember my first gardening memory is watching a bee go into an aquilegia and being mesmerised by the bumblebee coming in and out. And, you know, it was probably as tall as I was at that time, because I think probably it was about 2-3. So I went in to the garden, the small suburban garden in West London, and just got into plants straight away.
But not just plants, a love of insects from a very early age.
Yes, and one of the reasons that I'm green is definitely because of the era that I was born into, which was just... I was born in 1950, just after the Second World War. Money was tight. People didn't use chemicals in the way they started to use them in the 1970s. It was very much more hands-on gardening, and everybody saved their runner bean seeds and perhaps their seed potatoes. It was a different era. And also, my grandmother came from Yorkshire, and I've got her values. Mm-hmm. So I never wanted to use lots of chemicals. And then I was in London where wildlife was being depleted even when I was a child. And then I moved up to Leamington Spa as a cadet nurse when I was 16. and I cycled down the lanes, and I was just completely knocked over by the wildflowers and the insects.
So your grandmother was gardening organically, although we probably didn't call it organic gardening at that time, and that's stayed with you.
Well, everybody. I mean, this is one of the things that I always say in my talks, that everybody seems to think that organic gardening is newfangled, but it was the way our ancestors gardened. Mm. You know, for generations, they didn't use lots of chemicals. I mean, some of the big gardens where there was lots of money and lots of gardeners, they would use copper-based fungicides and things like that. But another reason that I'm organic is because, A, I love wildlife, but B, when I was 21 and I trained as a teacher, I went for a series of interviews for jobs and I didn't get one. And at the time, I had no idea why. But I always wore incredibly short miniskirts to every interview. So I ended up without a job. And I thought, well, I'll get another job and then I'll go back into teaching, in a year or so's time, because I'd gone from being a cadet nurse into a teacher training college. I'd had sort of 5 years of institutional living, basically. Yeah. So I was quite keen to get out in the world. And I went as a scientific officer at the National Vegetable Research Station at Wellesbourne.
Okay.
And I went to work for a guy called Peter Crisp, who bred brassicas. And I worked in virology and plant breeding. And after I'd been there a little while, I said to my boss, Pete, why did I get the job? Thinking he'd say I was sparky, I was intelligent. He said, couldn't resist the legs. So anyway, I was working there. We were using loads of chemicals. We were putting them on the fields. It was in the early 1970s. Lots of things were being sprayed on the fields. I was lighting nicotine cones in the greenhouse, usually having to go in several times on a Friday night to get the things alight. Mm. I've never smoked, but I'm sure I've inhaled lots of nicotine.
Yeah.
We were using benlate
regularly,
which is a really harmful fungicide, to graft cauliflower curd onto cauliflower plants, which I raised, and then to grow a seed crop. So we're using all these chemicals at Wellesbourne. And I don't know why, but I made the decision that I wasn't going to do any of that once I got out of Wellesbourne. So that sort of firmed me up, because I could see the difference in the way I'd gardened. And I became a teacher, and I had no money, and I was growing all my veg for my children. So I just carried on organically.
Had you went down the teacher route, you became a
yes.
teacher. Had you at any time thought about a career in horticulture other than the job you were just telling us about? Had that been on the radar?
No, not really, because I was very much had to be self-sufficient from the age of 16 because family life imploded. So my main consideration in life was to earn a living. Mm-hmm. And I come from a family where all the women had jobs, which was really unusual in the 1950s.
Yeah.
So I was always going to be a working woman, and I was always going to try and make a living. And I didn't, at that time, see that horticulture had anything to offer me. I was probably wrong. I probably could have had a really nice life in horticulture, but I was firmly wanting to get a profession and get on, and have a good salary. That was my impetus, and that impetus carried on right until my children were late teenagers, that I was working and teaching.
So you were teaching. What did you teach? What was your subject?
Well, I'm a literacy specialist. I spent most of my life reading books. My family were bohemian.
Bohemian. Now, go on, explain what you mean by bohemian, because I think we're both smiling here. What's your interpretation of bohemian?
Well, my father was in the film industry.
Oh, okay. Well, and what was his job?
He was a technician.
Okay.
And my grandfather was a stage manager and a technical bod in films. He got into films. He went to school with Arthur Rank.
The Arthur Rank, wow.
The Arthur Rank, because Arthur Rank owned a seed and flour mill near where my grandfather lived, which was in the Hull area. So he came down to London, and I worked in the theatre, first of all, and then in films. Well, that's a very racy life.
Well, yeah.
My grandfather worked with people like Dylan Thomas on the propaganda films. Well, I grew up in the environment where my parents were always out. You know, my grandmother was the rock. They were always out.
Yeah.
My brother and I are probably the most bookish people you could possibly wish to meet. We've never really gone down that route.
So a love of books as well, a love of reading.
Yes.
You were an English teacher. You specialised in, sorry, what did you say? How did you describe it?
Literacy.
Literacy.
And I ended up teaching infants, where you're always trying to spark them off with some interesting fact. You cannot get away in front of 4 and 5 year olds by being boring. You've got to be funny. You know, you've got to really get down to the nitty-gritty, and that helped me in my writing.
So as I say, all those seeds were sown, every pun intended, all those years ago. It was almost meant to be. So what happened? How did you start in garden writing? What happened in your career?
Well, I started in a very small way, as everybody does, not thinking that it would ever go anywhere, but I thought I've got to try it because I had all this plant knowledge. I used to buy plants all the time, and I'd be planting them and I'd be observing them. And at the time when I started garden writing in 95, everybody's writing was quite mundane in a way. It was always dig a hole a foot deep. You know, there was no magic in it. Mm. But there were little areas of magic that made me think it could be different. And one of those was Beth Chatto's nursery catalogue. I would get that catalogue. I would go to the nursery. And she would describe plants in such an imaginative way. She would talk about an astrantia being a small posy encircled by a ring of bracts. She had that sort of way of bringing a plant to life. And then there was another nurseryman called Bob Brown, and his descriptions in his early catalogues were amazing. He wrote about things, the poppy, Barbara Cartland, being like... Raspberry Queen, not Barbara Cartland. I've ruined it now. He wrote about Raspberry Queen being like Barbara Cartland leaning slightly with running mascara. So that's the sort of writing I wanted to do. I wanted it to be poetic and imaginative and literary because, you know, as a teenager I read loads of poetry and I came from a noisy, creative family and... You know, language was really important to me. So I wanted to write like that. So that's how I started. I started from in that vein straight away.
And were you conscious of trying to forge yourself a garden writing style in those earlier articles? Did you have to sit and think about it, or did it tend to flow quite naturally? Were you just being Val writing?
I was just being Val writing. That was exactly it. And I think that's what everybody has to do. They have to find their voice. And I think teaching helps you to find your voice.
So you submitted your first articles. What happened? How were you picked up? What was your first job? Who was responsible? Who was behind it all?
Well, I had a notebook. And I wrote... I had a new Mac computer, and I wrote a bank of 20 articles on things like pulmonarias, aquilegias, things I had things to say about. And I wrote these articles and I sent them off because there was no email in those days, in big brown envelopes. And I'd write in my notebook pulmonarias, and I'd send it to Amateur Gardening, and then it would come back. So I'd send it to Gardener's World and it would come back. So I sent it to some other magazine. You know, there were more magazines in those days. And then as it came back, I put a line through it and I tried to bump them about. And then I thought, well, this is really hard going. So I approached... Clive Nichols for a set of pictures and said, I think the way forward is for me to get perhaps a set of pictures that you haven't sold, and I'll write round it. And I tried four photographers: Eric Crichton, John Glover, Clive Nichols and Andrew Lawson, and it was only Clive who responded.
So how did you know Clive?
I didn't know him. Found him in some way, or met him at something. I didn't know him from Adam, but there was a winter set of pictures that they gave me and said, look, we haven't been able to sell this. And I always remember the opening paragraph started like something done. The sun barely rises at midday, and it was all about casting shadows and light and things like this. And I wrote this article around this set of pictures, and it was horticultural, but it started very creatively. And David Hurrian, who had a magazine in those days. I think it was called The Gardener, but I could be wrong. He picked it up.
Now, David Harrigan, coincidentally, was my tutor when I first started studying my RHS exams.
Well, David Harrigan is an amazing man. And I don't really say that because he noticed my article, because he commissioned six, but I only ever wrote one because the magazine folded. But then, because I'd had that one, Jim Ward of Garden News was the editor. He commissioned 20. And Val went home and wrote 20 and sent them all at once. And he said, "That's not how we do it, Val."
So when you look back on those early days of writing, has your voice, you talked about finding a voice when you're writing, has that voice stayed the same? Has it adapted? Have you changed consciously?
Well, I think you do change, but it's very difficult to actually pinpoint how you change when you're writing. But I mean, I never read anybody else. Peter Seabrook used to say to me, he used to email me and say, "Have you seen that?" And I'd email back and say, "Peter, I don't read anybody else. I will not read." There are exceptions. I have read Christopher Lloyd's gardening books and Marjorie Fish's since I was young. But I will not read another garden writer. That's because I don't want to plagiarise them. I want my ideas to be mine. I think it's the infant teacher in me. It all to be first-hand experience. And this is where my garden is so important to me, because I'm learning all the time. I write a column for The Hardy Plant called The Learning Curve. Mm. And that's what gardening is. It's a learning curve because conditions change. We're experiencing climate change. Mm. I'm learning which plants I probably will have to abandon. I'm learning techniques of shading plants so they don't get so stressed.
And I guess that's something we're all learning all of the time. We're chatting today after a heat wave where temperatures have soared, the hottest temperatures in the UK ever. Have you found that some of the things that you have learnt, you're having to relearn again because of this?
Well, I mean, it's been amazing, that heat. I mean, I was fine in the heat. I really enjoyed the heat. Mm. But I couldn't come out and garden in it. We came out and sat in the shade and had tea and things like that. But I have had, all my roses browned, all the hardy geraniums, they shriveled up. And I think it's really important. I've noticed that colour is really important, flower colour is really important. I'm not a fan of white here, I never have been. The champagne moment roses are looking white, but actually they're quite a creamy colour. Mm. White's very harsh here because we're on top of the Cotswolds, it's a hard light. And I like rich colour. But if you have a dark flower or a dark rose, that shrivels up much more than a paler colour. And that's altering my choices. And 10 years ago, I would never have hesitated in recommending prairie planting if you want to create an autumn border that persists through winter. But now a lot of those prairie plants aren't working because they're shallow rooted. Mm. So things like Helianthus lemon queen, which were great, reliable plants that flowered every year, the last 10 years, they're very hit and miss. Mm. So I think we're going to have to go adapt our planting to the things that do well. I mean, I'm planting more Hamaracallis. I'm planting probably more monocots like Crocosmias and things because they are more drought resistant. And I've got a line of Clematis viticella at the back of the summer house because we do face due south. That hasn't shown any distress in the heat.
What's your soil like here?
We're above the spring line. And one of the things that the best beloved said to me when he bought this wreck of a house with its derelict garden was, "The soil is wonderful, Val." Oh. And it does strain your hands really dark. It's deep.
Right.
We are not on Cotswold brash here.
No.
You can dig down and a lot of the soil goes down a long way. And there is spring water trickling under parts of this garden and that definitely helps certain things. So I would say that the soil is fairly good, but it dries out. It doesn't hold on to nutrients. There's very little clay content in it. But if you went over the road to the garden over there, that is heavy clay because the spring comes out and the spring runs along the clay layer. And, you know, so there are areas of this this village that haven't got good soil, but we have.
And I was coming here thinking Spring Cottage was to reflect the season, but the spring as in the water.
It's the water, yes.
So when it comes to planting, you and the Best Beloved, do you have similar ideas on planting and favoured plants? Or so often we talk about people who garden together who have very different views and ideas.
I think I have a very different style of planting to Joe. I always say that I want gardens to look like women in slightly small underwear. I want them to burst out, to be ebullient and enthusiastic. And I plant much more deeply, I think, and densely than Joe would. But that goes with the ecological idea of trying to keep your soil in good heart, because if you expose your soil to the sun and the rain and the wind, you break down the soil ecology and you make it harder for all the helpful ground beetles and things to travel through the garden. So I like to see as little soil as possible. And at the moment, I'm taking up some Olaya grandiflora that is self-seeded. It's an annual umbellifer.
Yeah.
And I'm taking it out and I'm saving the seed. And I'm immediately going to plant it up with something else. I've got some Verbena bonariensis, and I've also got a wonderful grass called Stipa barbata, which is like a Goldilocks of a grass. And I've got some, I'm going to put some of those in. So the whole garden is full of snowdrops.
Now there's a love of snowdrop, a galanthophile in the make, well, not in the making, sort of like probably one of the original galanthophiles. What snowdrops do you have in the garden?
I have about 300 different ones.
300 different ones?
Yeah, and I have them. And the Best Beloved is very unkind about my snowdrops because he says they all have to be labelled, obviously, because, you know, even people like me who are mad keen on snowdrops, they wouldn't be able to recognise every one of them without a label, which is rather the sadness of it all, really.
Yeah, but not with 300 varieties. I mean, goodness me.
Oh, I do. Some of them are very distinctive. I know them anywhere. But I went over to black labels, but I walked on them all in the summer. So what? In February, this whole garden has got snowdrops under the roses, snowdrops at the front of that border, snowdrops all through here, and snowdrops all in these areas. He calls them the National Collection of White Labels. But the snowdrops give me great joy.
Where did the love of snowdrops come from? Where can you remember your first love affair with a snowdrop?
I remember the snowdrop. When I first started writing, the queen of the snowdrops was a lady called Primrose Warburg, and she had a garden at Oxford called South Hayes, and it was on Yarnall's Hill. And she was very, very intimidating. And I wanted to meet her, but I was too shy to go and see her. And she died in October 96. And a man from Wisley got invited to go to the garden, John Grimshaw, who's big man in snowdrops. And he was curating the garden and labelling up the snowdrops and divvying them up into people's collections and botanic gardens. And this man from Wisley asked me whether I would like to go to Primrose Warburg's garden. I jumped at the opportunity. I have to say, he wasn't just interested in snowdrops. It was all a bit embarrassing, but there you are, it's another story.
This isn't the miniskirt again.
No, I'd gone out of the miniskirt by then. But I went to Primrose Warburg's garden, which was on a south-facing slope. And every time a house came up for sale on Yarnall's Hill, Primrose and her husband were very wealthy. They bought the house and chopped off the garden. So there were 2 or 3 acres of garden on this slope, and there was a woodland garden. And the crocuses were out. It was a beautiful day. It was early February. The snowdrops were allowed to self-seed. The crocuses were out. I was absolutely spellbound. And there was a yellow snowdrop right by the house with the label PC. And everybody was looking at it. And in those days, there weren't many yellow snowdrops. And where had it come from? And people said it might be Phil Cornish because of PC, but it wasn't. It was from a lady called Philippa somebody up in Northumberland, and that was the snowdrop that went on to be called Primrose Warburg. So at the end of the thing, we all had to write in the book which snowdrops we would like. Well, I didn't write anything in the book because who was I to ask for snowdrops? I didn't come from Oxford Botanic Garden or Cambridge Botanic Garden. I wasn't one of these big wigs. And John Grimshaw very kindly said to me afterwards, would you like some snowdrops? I can give you some of the common things. What would you like? So he dug me up some Lady Beatrix Stanley, which is a fantastic double.
Yeah.
He dug me up Augustus, which is a plicate named after E.A. Bowles. He dug me up some Greater X doubles. And then he said to me, is there something special you would really love? And I said, I would love a trim. And I called trim a pixie hat.
Okay.
So I went home with about 7 different snowdrops. And I planted them in Hook Norton, where I was living. And I made these huge labels.
White ones?
Actually, I think they were grey, but they were huge labels, wooden labels. And I wrote on the labels. And the best beloved came to the garden and he said, they're tombstones. And I said, no, they're not. That's my new snowdrop collection. And you say, Joe would not collect plants in the way I collect plants. He wouldn't bother. But I got hooked then and I started to sort of collect them and buy them. And it just went from there to there. And I've made so many delightful friends through snowdrops. Mm. And that's the thing about a garden. I go around this garden and I think, oh, so-and-so gave me that.
Memories.
Yeah, they're people. They're not just plants.
Yeah.
Plants are so much more, you know, than a flower on a stalk. They remind you of things. And my snowdrops give me great joy. I'm an avid plant collector. I have a big collection of hardy ferns here. I grow a lot of trilliums. And when I first started, I grew trilliums from seed. They took 9 years to flower.
I was going to say, you have to be very patient for trilliums from seed.
I said to the best beloved, I could have 4 children if I was young enough. In that time, I could have one little trillium flower. I grow peonies from seed. I've got a lot of peonies in this garden. I've got a lot of species peonies. I've got probably about 50 herbaceous peonies. I'm completely mad on all sorts of plants, and I have collections of things, and the best beloved wouldn't do that. But that's how I've spent my money, and that's how I've made a living out of writing about plants. I actually write about what I find out about them. I'm not bothered about what anybody else thinks.
So picking back up on the writing again, I don't know if you're familiar with the book Misery by Stephen King. It's about an author, Paul Sheldon, who goes away and writes a book in a certain hotel at a certain time of the year. He has a certain drink ready. So when you're writing, do you have a place to go to write? Do you need to be in the mood to write? Do you have any routines just for good luck?
Well, I think when you're a writer, I earned £50 in the first 6 months. You can't wait for the muse to descend. You have to be disciplined, and teaching teaches you how to be disciplined. Mm. You're in that classroom, 8:15, getting ready to teach. You know what you're going to do. I've carried on. I start writing at 8:30, possibly 9 o'clock, 8:30. And that is a regular routine. When I first started writing, I had a computer that put in... you could put CDs in, and I would put my CD of Van Morrison in, and I would write to that. So if I'm going to write, I write in a very disciplined way, and I stick at it. And when I was writing for practically everybody, about 7 or 8 years ago, I started to weed out things, probably 6 years ago, something like that. But when I was writing for everybody, I had to write every day. And if I trialled plants at Wisley, I would write at the weekends. And if I was doing a book, I would write in the evenings. It was all consuming.
Mm.
So I had to be very disciplined.
And are you able to just sit down and write almost to command? Or do you you don't have to be in a certain place? You just learn how to write.
Yeah, I just do it. I think that teaching is... It gives you that sort of iron discipline. You know you've got to do it. You can't say to yourself, oh, I'll prevaricate, I'll go down to Tesco's first. I know that's the road to disaster.
Yeah.
You know, I will if I'm writing. And when I've written something, I write it quite quickly. You know, it's. I always say that when you're doing a book, it's a bit like having a stomach bug. You've got to get it out. It's almost as though you're going to be sick. I don't. The Best Beloved and I have had some interesting conversations because he's an academic, and academics put everything into an article.
Mm.
And when I wrote my book, The Natural Gardener, he read it and said, "You haven't done this, you haven't done that." And I said, "No, I've deliberately not done that."
Mm.
You know, you have to be selective. It has to be readable, enjoyable, funny.
So when you're writing here, do you give the drafts to your Best Beloved to have a little look through, or are you confident enough to say, "No, I know what I'm doing now"?
I wouldn't give him anything to look at. I learnt my lesson. When I was doing The Natural Gardener, he's up the garden listening.
Yeah, and I'm worried because I'm thinking one of us is going to be in big trouble here.
You're worried about those rock cakes he's made. He might not give you one.
Well, I can smell them still, and I'm thinking, well, I've got to be very careful here because I do want a rock cake before I go home.
Yes. No, I, the one thing I have learnt to do, if it's an important article, and I do think garden writing is important, I don't think it's valued nearly enough.
No.
And all the papers have gone down a lot of them have gone down the lifestyle route. They don't do serious stuff anymore. You know, they'd rather have a sort of girl in a summer frock who looks good and knows nothing. And I'm certainly beyond those days of looking good and, you know, all the rest of it. And I just think, you know, it is important to pass on information.
Mm.
You know, it is important to have a view about things. You know, I learnt to be opinionated as a small child because I had two brothers and eight boy cousins. I have got the words engraved on my heart, "Go deeper," because I never got to bat in the cricket games. So I learnt to be pushy.
I'm sorry, I was just chatting. I caught that beautiful Agapanthus in front of us with the dark purple. Which one is that, do you know?
I do know. We've got several Agapanthus here. I'm just trying to focus on which one it is. I think there's...
right in front, the really inky...
I think that is Alan Street. Alan Street found a seedling. It's a very, very dark navy blue. And previously, all the dark navy blue Agapanthus produced very little flower. So Black Panther, if you're lucky, might produce two flowers.
Mm.
Alan Street, which was launched by Avon Bobs about 4 or 5 years ago, was on the trial. It got an AGM, and it produces masses of flower. But we've also got Windsor Grey behind,
yeah,
which is the tall grey one.
Mm.
I think I probably wouldn't grow that if I was ruthless. But Northern Star is a very, very good one because it's a deciduous one. The foliage is very dark at the base. It's a very good dark blue flower, so that's a very good one. We've got Midnight Star here. We've got a late one, which is a mauve one called Tarka. But some of the best ones I've got, actually, you always tell people that they shouldn't buy cheap Agapanthus from bulb suppliers, don't you?
Mm.
Well, when I was at Hook Norton and I was in my writing phase, I used to have very little money, and I used to work in a gym in the evening and all sorts of other jobs. And I bought 10 Agapanthus from Peter Nyson for £1 each, and they are some of the best ones that I have got. And they're Donau. They're a cut flower variety,
yeah, yeah,
that they grow in the fields, and then they dig them up and get rid of them, and they flog them. And you know, they're some of the best. And that I didn't know what it was, but Steve Hickman, who's got one of the national collections, he identified it for me as Donau. And you know, they're pretty good, really.
I have to say, I'm sorry. This is one of the downsides of doing a chat in the garden. You find yourself looking around, so I was very momentarily distracted there. But talking of the plants and going back to the writing, if you were talking about Agapanthus, for example, or snowdrops, do you have that knowledge up in your head to just write, or do you need to have a wander around the garden and have a good look at your snowdrops, your Agapanthus, before you start committing to...
No, I think I'm looking at my garden all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm quite clear about why I started garden writing. I wanted to earn enough money to spend more time gardening, because I hadn't got a moment to live when I was teaching. It was teaching is such a pressurised job, you know, especially, I think, the deputy head is the glitch. you know, in everybody's career, you either go onto a headship or you think, oh, I'm going to, you know, and women have got such a workload anyway. They've got, you know, with their families and things. So, you know, I don't know really. I spend the whole time, I mean, my whole life is, you know, starting writing at 8:30, and then I'll write for a bit, and I write until 12:30, I then stop for a bite of lunch, I then write again, usually, if I'm having an intensive day, and then I might get to 3:00, 3:30 at this time of year, and then it's in the garden for a couple of hours, and then, you know, I might have something to eat in the evening. I'm lucky that the best beloved cooks very well, so I can often stay in the garden and then be called in for supper, and then I'm out again. It's my playground.
Wow.
You know, I've got this enthusiasm for plants, and I like to be outside, and I like the physical work. I think it's in my genes. My mother had a great work ethic. My father was always on location in the film industry because he liked the outdoors. I was born to be outdoors.
So when you're not outdoors and you're writing, just coming back to the books again, your first book, was that Seeds of Wisdom in 2003?
I know. I had a column at the time in the Telegraph called Seeds of Wisdom, and I would phone up a head gardener and get a tip. And they were very varied. I mean, Helen Dillon said about not having a male dog because they squirt their urine upwards, you know, get a female dog so it wees on the lawn, you know. Lord Carrington, always take your secateurs in the garden, and I wear gardening things that hold secateurs.
Yeah.
I never go out without my secateurs. I love that transition. When I'm writing, I wear really smart clothes, because if I didn't, I'd see something and I'd be in there in the garden, whereas if I've got a bra or a blouse on, I don't. So I'm smart, and then I rip everything off. Not a nice sight. Put my gardening clothes on, and I've gone. I feel like Wonder Woman.
So when you're dressed up, you're Foulbourn the writer.
Yes.
And that puts you in the mood for the writing. And then when you're out in the garden, you get your gardening clobber on.
Yes.
And
yes. It reminds me of my daughter when she was a child, Fran. I've got two daughters, Fran and Zoe, very different. Fran, I used to say, because I was a working mother, right, we're going to tidy up this house, go and do your bedrooms. Fran would put her Wonder Woman costume on in order to tidy up her bedroom. And I'm like that in the garden. I'm Wonder Woman.
Didn't she have a glass plane or something as well?
Oh, I don't know. I think
she had. Oh, let's move on very, very quickly then.
I know she had a gold skirt because Fran had one.
Now, that's completely put me off my straight now. I was going to go somewhere with that. Now, what was I going to say? So we've got the Seeds of Wisdom book was your first book.
Yes.
So how did that actually come about?
Well, Camilla Stoddart, who was working for, I think it was Cassell. She was lovely to work for. She phoned me up. I'm sure her name was Camilla Stoddart. It's a long time ago. And she phoned me up and said they thought it would make a very good book. So I said, right. She said, yes, but she said, you've got 4 weeks to write it. So I thought, well, that's fine. I can do that because I am Wonder Woman. Not.
Gold skirt on.
Yes, gold skirt on. But you try phoning head gardeners up, because I had so many tips. And I said, can I use some of the same tips? She said, yes. So we went through, I think, a month. I can't really remember, a month at a time. And you try phoning head gardeners up and asking them for a tip. You never get them on the phone.
Mm.
They say they'll phone you back, they don't.
Mm.
Or they phone you back at 9 at night when you're absolutely shattered.
Yeah.
And then you have to write it down. So I did get it done, and it was a good seller. And for a long time afterwards, I used to go and interview people about their gardens, because, you know, I don't rush around the country like I used to. But I would go into some swanky house's loo, and I see my Seeds of Wisdom in the loo, and I think, that's not...
Wow. I've made it.
Yes. Or I went to a swanky hotel once. Somebody else paid. It was a pressure.
That's the best way to do it.
Yeah. And on in each bathroom there was a copy of Seeds of Wisdom. I thought, wow, that's really good.
So talking about making it, what was that the moment that you became Foulbourn, the well-known and well-respected writer, or did something else happen before or after that to really put you on the map?
To go back to Clive, when I got those set of pictures from Jane, who was Clive's wife, I spoke to Clive and I said, I don't think I know whether I'm going to make it. I don't know whether I'm going to fail completely. He said, Val, be like a woodpecker. Keep pecking away and take no as a short version of not yet.
Good advice.
Piece of advice from Clive. And that's what I did. And my life has been quite tough. I had to do my A-levels at Tech in order to get into teacher training college. When I was teaching, I had two small children. I went back when my youngest child was 15 months, so I had one of two and one of just over one. Mm. I've never had that easy life where I've been able to make choices. I've always have to graft and go for it. And I just did exactly the same, and that's what I'd advise people to do. If you're going to be successful at something, it doesn't arrive by magic. It's all about graft. Mm. And that's what I did. I grafted. And I when people bounced an article back at me, as they did, and said it's not what we want, I didn't grouse about it. I just rewrote it. I listened to them and I rewrote it and I learnt from it. And that's all the advice I can give people. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with my career as I sit here, 72 in a week's time. I just don't know whether, you know, what will happen. I've no idea what will happen. But I'm just I enjoy writing. I enjoy work. What would I do on a grotty day and, you know, in the middle of nowhere?
We were chatting before we came out to sit in the garden to record this, and you said that there's another book there.
Yes, there is. Definitely.
Can you share anything about that?
I can only tell you that I've written, I think, 8 or 9 books, and gardening books don't sell terrifically well, but what they do is they give you a chance to show your wares in a way. Mm. It's not about kudos. It's about extending your writing, because when you write anything, I'm writing an article for Plant Life at the moment, on winter highlights and ecology and all the rest of it. I've got 1,200 words. You know, I'm constantly picking out the bones. Mm. And when you do a book, you can put the flesh on the bones. So you know, I've done the winter garden, I've done colour in the garden. I can't even remember what I've done. I've done the 10-minute gardener. They were a real trial because, you know, you're covering 3 subjects. But I am a vegetable gardener. I grow huge amounts of my own vegetables here. We've got a big allotment. We do grow fruit. I'm an all-round gardener. Mm. So, but they were a trial. But the next book, the hardest book I've done was definitely The Living Jigsaw, because it was ecological and it covered so much. The next book is going to be a much simpler book. And if you know the book that David Damoni wrote about houseplants, that's going to be my template. I'm going to do an easier book about ecology that people don't have to read a whole chapter.
So whilst these books are up in your head, you're mulling it over. Are you mulling over the framework, the sort of like the chapters? When you come to write, are you ready, as you say, get it out?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I wrote the 3 10-minute gardeners, yeah, and Colour in the Garden. I wrote one a month, as well as my journalistic writing.
Yes, I noticed that, those 3 books, all in 2011, within weeks almost of each other.
Yes, I wrote them one month after another. And when I had finished, I think I wrote Colour in the Garden first, which has never sold. It's a good book, but it's never sold. And I wrote the flower book and then the vegetable book. And then I wrote the fruit book, because I knew that would be the trickiest of all for me, because although I grow fruit, fruit's a very specialised subject, but I wanted to write about the way I grow fruit, definitely. I wanted to get that organic message across. I wanted to put little interesting snippets in. But when I'd finished those 3 books, my twin brother died very suddenly.
Oh, goodness.
And I was in like a, you know, a grey fog. Mm. So I did the fruit book almost on, you know, autopilot.
Yeah.
But I gave it to Jerry Edwards, who's the chair of the Fruit Committee, after it was published. I should have given it to him before, but there wasn't time. I gave it to him and said, look, I think these books are going to be reprinted. Would you please do me the courtesy of reading through this and letting me know if there is any, are there any major blips in it that need... And he said, no. He came back and said, no, it's fine. And then we did the compendium of the fruit and vegetable books, Chance World and Penguin were the best publishers I've worked for. They're brilliant. They got them into Marks and Spencer's. They gave them away through the book people. You know, they were amazingly proactive.
So, another book.
Yes.
What next for you? I know you're doing my podcast here today, but you also appear on the podcast Talking Dirty with Alan Gray and Thordis Fredriksen.
I have never listened to them. I have never watched them. But I was at the Malvern show. I saw you there.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Several people who sort of... Because people sort of know what you look like. They have a vague idea. And several people came up and said, I love Talking Dirty. And I looked at them and I thought, oh, I don't know. And I went to a lovely garden near Chepstow called Windcliff Court. Do you know it?
I do know it, yeah.
It's beautiful. Yeah. I'd recommend a garden visit there any day. Lovely girl called Sarah Clay. And she watches these podcasts, not just mine, lots of podcasts, mm-hmm. when she's cooking in the kitchen. You know, she obviously got an iPod or a phone or something.
Yeah.
She listens and watches them. I have never watched those podcasts because I cannot bear the thought of seeing myself.
Well, that's why this is a winner, because mine's just audio. But of
yes.
course, Talking
I put
Dirty.
On.
Well, I put mine on. Talking Dirty, obviously, it's on YouTube as well, so you can see.
Yes.
It's your episode, and it's one of my favourite podcasts, just listening to Eric and Eric. Who's Eric? Where did Eric come from? Alan and Thordis.
Yeah,
yeah, great.
Yeah.
So you've done some podcasts. Anything else? I mean, your garden here, how do you see it developing? Is there another garden, or is this your forever garden?
Oh, I don't think I could move. You've got to remember that. I've been here 17 years. There was nothing in the garden. I planted the fruit trees.
Mm.
You know, they're cropping. I don't think I have a time to make another garden, sadly.
Mm.
I mean, I'm terrifically lucky. I'm touching wood here that I can still garden all day.
Yeah.
You know, and I do stuff, you know, all the time. You know, I really enjoy the whole physical thing of gardening and being out there in all weathers. I know I'll go out on the coldest day here because I prefer to be outdoors.
Yeah.
So I think this is probably my forever garden. And I think that when I get to the stage when perhaps I've got a Zimmer frame or something, I shall just let it go wild. I shan't bother too much.
Well, I have to say, sitting here today with you, looking at this beautiful garden, irrespective of the heat wave, it's stunning, it's beautiful. Thank you so much for inviting me here today, and thank you for sparing some of your busy schedule to come and have a chat.
Oh, it's been lovely. I really, really appreciate people coming to the garden. Sarah Clay from Windcliff is coming
yeah.
here next Wednesday, and I'm busy collecting some Olaya seed for her because she's a really keen, enthusiastic gardener.
Well, I have to say, Olaya is one of my favourites as well. And like yours, mine has gone to seed at home. And every year there's more and more seed,
yes.
which means more and more Olaya, which is wonderful.
Yes. Well, I'm not going to put Olaya there again because I don't like the colour of it just there. I'm actually going to put Verbena bonariensis there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to put my new steeper plants there, Vestipa barbata. Because, you know, what I try to do here, because I'm really keen on wildlife, is to have diversity. So I've got trees and shrubs and all sorts of plants. And I try to have flower throughout the year. So that's a big thing for me. So I think I'm much going to prefer having... Did you hear the green woodpecker?
Yes, I did, yeah.
I'm much going to prefer, you know, having Verbena bonariensis there, which would be in flower now and setting off the agapanthus better than a brown lot of seed heads. We get the woodpecker in, the green woodpecker in, when it comes in into the anthill.
It's, as hey, I'm just looking, there's a great tit on the bird feeder there. It's just lovely, Val. Thank you so much. And I'm just hoping we haven't upset the best beloved, because those rock cakes did look rather lovely.
Oh, no, he's a very generous man.
He's
a very kind man. He wouldn't be able to... No one else could put up with me.
Thank you so much, Val. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I hope that's all right.
Well, I spent a wonderful few hours with Val and her best beloved, Joe. and I can report back that the rock cakes were first class. And just between you and I did go in for a cheeky second one. I was asked, I didn't just take it, honestly. Val took me to her allotment after we recorded the episode, and it was wonderful to see her collection of dahlias, the sweet corn, peas, and so much more growing away. I even stayed and got my hands dirty and did a little bit of weeding with her. Thank you, Val and Joe, for making me feel so welcome that day. It was wonderful to spend time with you both and in your garden. If you want to learn more about Val, do head to her website, valborn.co.uk, and do have a look at the book section. I have a few of Val's books in my collection, and The Living Jigsaw is my latest acquisition, and I can tell you for a fact it's a great, fact-filled and very informative read in Val's usual enthusiastic style. Well, as you can probably hear, I'm out in the garden now. The lawn looks like a piece of shredded wheat. It's just brown like cardboard with the odd green tinge just on the sides. And I'm going to leave it. I'm going to revel in the fact that it's a lovely golden colour, and that represents the beautiful summer that we've had so far. Now, I shall wait for the rain to return, which it will do at some point, and when that returns, so will my lush green verdant lawn at some point in the next few weeks. So, have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye for now. Bye-bye.